but I quickly put it into my pocket and tended Duri. He seemed to be in a trance, in a sleepwalker's state. Otherwise, he appeared pretty much as he was when he had left us. I asked him what he had seen. He looked at me in anguish, he could not speak. Iris and I led Uri over the bumpy mud field to the car. Finally Uri spoke, "Andrea, please let's get away from here." I drove the car to a quiet area about a mile away. Uri asked me to park. He was still in a daze, but I just had to persist in finding out what had happened. He told me the following story, which I tape recorded on my TC-120. When I left you, I climbed down and then up a slope, where I saw this light clearly. There was a large cypress tree behind it. I also saw the blue light clearly against the tree. The light was pure blue. Then I went into a hollow and lost sight of the light. As I climbed out of the hollow, the light loomed over me. I walked without any thought or feeling. Then I put out my hands, and in them there appeared your pen cartridge. I don't know what happened next. My mind was blank. The next thing I know, I saw you and Iris. How long was it? You were out there about 4 minutes, I reported. It seemed like hours, Uri replied. Iris had been very quiet. I asked her what she had seen. She reported that she had seen and heard the same thing as I had. She was very sure of the blue light and the cricket sound, but was not sure of what was below the blue light. We dared not state what we suspected, but were not sure of the possibility of there being a hull under the blue light. We decided to return to Tel Aviv to go to a coffee shop and talk it all over. Uri insisted on driving. Iris talked to Uri in Hebrew, trying to get him to recall what had happened. I sat in the back seat, going over all the events of the day. But the almost preposterous thought kept coming back to me, that was not anything supernormal that we saw in the field. It was all some kind of hallucination. Maybe that blue light was all hallucinated. Uri had fooled me. He palmed that cartridge off on me by buying a duplicate. But then how did he know my own serial number? So my thoughts went on in circles. Since Uri and Iris were in a loud animated conversation in the front seat, I thought that I would tape record some of my thoughts. I was sure they would not notice me. I reached in the dark for my tape recorder and pressed the forward and record buttons. They were jammed. I turned on my pen light and looked at the recorder. The cassette on which I had recorded Uri's impressions of the experience in the field had vanished. I felt this was an object lesson to my doubting Thomas attitude. I showed this effect to Iris, and she confirmed that I had indeed tape recorded my interview with Uri some 20 minutes earlier. We went to the coffee shop and ordered some snacks. We tried to make some sense out of our experience. Skeptical though we were, we seemed to agree on all the details I have recorded up to the point where Uri left Iris and me and walked toward the blue light. But none of us could really accept the possibility that the blue light might be associated with a UFO. Uri could not clearly remember what he had seen in the field after he walked toward the blue light. But I could see that something was gnawing away at him. He told Iris that he was very tired and upset by the evening and wanted to retire. Iris was very understanding and agreed that he should get some rest. We drove Iris to her home. As soon as she was gone, Uri said that we must work some more tonight. I remember much more than I let on before Iris. I just don't want her to take all this seriously. I want her to forget it. You and I will have to keep this matter secret until we can get some sign that others can know. But I tell you, I know it is real. When I was out in that field, I realized for the first time in my life where my powers come from. Now I know for sure they are not my powers. Oh, I know that I have a little bit of telepathy and psychokinesis. Everybody has some. But making things vanish, and having things come back, and the red light in the sky in the Sinai, the blue light tonight, that is the power of some superior being. Maybe it is what man always thought of as being God. We drove back to apartment 61 in Herzliya Heights. Somehow the shock of Uri articulating his real feelings wiped out my doubts. It also gave me a strange sense of helplessness. When we got back to the apartment, Uri asked me to bring out my very large steel camera trunk. He took my Nizo movie camera encased in a plastic bag, which still contained the film cartridge with which I had filmed the event in the field. He locked the camera in the trunk. He asked me to open the trunk in 15 seconds, which I did. There was the Nizo camera in the intact plastic bag, but when I opened the camera, the Ektar 160 film cartridge was not there. It had vanished. To a research man, the idea of losing data was unthinkable, but to have it vanish was sickening. As I write these lines long after the event, I have in my possession but very few bits of evidence. There are the photographs taken in Brazil of the lights in the night sky. There is Yuri's photograph of the UFO in daylight over the Israel Army headquarters. And there is a photograph taken over West Germany from an airplane of three spacecraft. This latter photo will be described later. However, every magnetic tape cassette on which was recorded the voice of Spectra, and the voices of other beings later recorded, has vanished. With such sparse evidence, it was apparent to me that I could never try to convince another human being of my experiences. The secret of Spectra was safe because they had leaked out just enough information to convince me of their reality, but not enough for me to ever convince any other human being. Chapter 5, When Time Stood Still. Now that Uri and I had come to accept the reality of this mysterious being as well as its power, we were naturally intensely curious as to whom we were dealing with. We felt very much like people in prison who hear tapping on the other side of the wall and who must try to guess who the tappers are and the meaning of their message. Every session that we had had to date was a one-way affair, in which we were subject to seeing or hearing a brief message and then it was cut. We tried to figure out some way of opening up a dialogue that was meaningful to us within our human framework. We came to the conclusion that we must try once again the proven technique of trance induction, and try to make the contact, and then ask our questions. Yuri had the evening of December 9th free, and we attempted to make our contact then. At 10:59 p.m. Yuri was in hypnotic trance. App, please ask if I can use the tape recorder. Yuri, I am alone here. There is no one to ask the question of. Then I heard a voice. Not from Ori, for he was asleep. The voice had no source. Andrea, I have told Ori to come to me now. App, may I use the tape recorder? If you do not want to lose the fourth cassette, you will not record. The tape recorder was placed aside. Take this, Yuri, hand it over to Andrea. I opened Ori's clenched left hand. There was my missing earphone from my Sony ICR-100 radio in its leather case. It had been translocated from wherever I had lost it weeks ago, most probably New York City. The voice in the room went on, "You have done everything. Do as Yuri says. How are you feeling? How is your energy?" App, my energy is tops. I feel as though I am in my 20s again. May I ask some questions purely for my own needs? Yes, proceed. App, are you of the nine principles that once spoke through Dr. Vinod? Yes. Are you behind the UFO sightings that started in the United States when Kenneth Arnold saw nine flying saucers on June 24, 1947? Yes. App, when did you first notice me? In 1946. App, why was I noticed? Our computers studied everyone on Earth. You were noticed for your abilities as the ideal and perfect man for this mission. App, what is this mission? Do not ask. It will be revealed. Yuri, be prepared. Be wise. Be calm. Calm down. There is a very, very heavy task on your shoulders for the next coming 50 years. There is a lot to be done to help the universe. The cosmic brain will be sent to you. Andrea, I am sending Yuri back to you now. Do whatever he wants. Take care of him. App, may I ask one more question? Yes, App. Do you have a name? Yes, but it is not to be revealed to you yet. This answer made me realize that Spectra was not the name of the being with whom I was speaking. App, how can we communicate with you? You cannot. We will reach you. We can command any communication system man has devised to reach you. Be alert. We will use your tape, phone, radio, television, telegram, letters, computers, and so on. Farewell. The communication ended at 11:09 p.m. when Uri awoke. I repeated to him from my notes what was said. He did not seem interested. He said, "Andrea, I do not like to think all these heavy things. I am here to do things for people. You are here to think and speak. I would rather not hear about these things. I have to remain simple like a child. I really get depressed if I have to think hard about anything, for any length of time." "I understand," I replied. "Uri, it is a heavy burden we have taken on. But we must do it joyfully, like servants who sing at their work. We must not take ourselves too seriously." "You're right, Andrea," Uri replied. "God can do anything he wishes. We have seen enough already to know this. Then why does he need us? You know, in the battle for the Golan Heights, we had fighter aircraft, helicopters, tanks, and all kinds of complex machines. But do you know the only creature or thing that could go up the steep mountains was the donkey? You and I are donkeys. If we keep that in mind, we will carry our burden lightly." The idea of Uri and I being donkeys seemed to describe Atul perfectly. Uri went home just after midnight. Before going to bed I checked my tape recorder, because I wanted to rewind it to the beginning. I tried but found that it would not rewind. I tried to eject the cassette, but the ejector mechanism would not work. Since I could neither rewind nor eject, I got curious and decided to see if anything had been done to the tape. So I pressed the forward key and it worked. To my utter surprise I found that the entire session with Uri had been recorded. This was amazing in that I had set aside the recorder. Furthermore, after the audible communication had ended at 11:09 p.m., there was a further message which said, "Andrea, on the 20th hypnotize Uri. We will place any messages to you on this machine. Present war is the important thing. Pray. Peace." The last message was in a voice totally new to me. It was in English but had the mechanical quality of synthesized speech. There was no signature. This was to be the first of many messages that appeared to me orally in this totally impersonal medium. When I had finished playing and transcribing this tape, a hall light that had been inoperative for 4 days suddenly switched on and off by some invisible hand. Somehow I knew that this meant wipe out the tape, or it will vanish. Reluctantly I wiped the tape clean of the recorded material. The events of this day, December 9, 1971, finally brought my lifetime quest into sharp focus. What had made it all fall into place was that last message that had appeared on the tape independently of Uri's presence. There was no use trying to go to sleep that night. I sat down to write out my thoughts about the greater mysteries. I had always been puzzled by man's use of the word God. When the Bible says that God spoke to or he spoke to God, I had always assumed it was a figure of speech. It never occurred to me that humans could speak to God, and even now I could not accept the idea. But if humans were reached by beings from space who were so superior that man in his ignorance identified them with gods, the Elohim of the Bible, or God, then the literary allusions became clear. If I had had my experiences with Uri in the time of Moses, I would have leapt to the conclusion that I was dealing with God. In addition to the confused record with respect to God and gods, I now felt that the role of prophets and sages in human affairs became more understandable. In biblical times, Uri Geller would eventually be honored as a prophet in local religious lore. Today he was a show freak and a guinea pig for science. The elements of this prophetic strain in human affairs now seemed to be quite simple. First, there must exist a local cosmic being of superior intelligence who has been assigned by an even more superior being to a task on Earth. Somehow the cosmic being has control of intelligent energy, or energy, for brevity, by means of which it can create any form of matter energy it desires. Thus the local cosmic being can assume any form it wishes to suit its purpose. For example, if it wishes to appear to some Earth person, it chooses a form suitable to the local taste. In ancient Egypt, the sun god, Ra, for example, was said to appear in the form of a hawk called Hor, or as corrupted by the Greeks, Horus. Another aspect of energy as used by the cosmic brain is to imitate any local language that is appropriate for getting a message across. Still another is the power to decreate thoughts or matter forms, as I have already reported. This aspect of energy would account for all the sudden appearances and vanishings of mythological lore, as well as modern UFO reports. It could also take the form of matter energy being transported, stored invisibly, or recalled to and from different places on Earth, or in the universe. I had the very strong feeling that the cosmic being does not normally exist in our space-time framework, except when it is necessary for it to interact with humans. Through these principles I have just cited, I believe that a prophet, an Uri Geller, if you wish, is specifically created to serve as an intermediary between a divine intelligence and man. The same idea would hold for living beings existing anywhere on any planet in the universe. I now fully believe that life exists anywhere and everywhere in the universe as divine intelligence dictates. I was prepared to believe that life exists in forms and states beyond the imagination of man to conceive. Now I was totally convinced that Uri and I had been contacted by such a local cosmos being, by this I mean some representative or extension of the nine principles. In this sense I believe that a cosmic being is superior to any life that exists on any planet in a material form. But for this I did not have any proof. I am well aware that any clever race of beings from another planet who were reconnoitering Earth could easily fool me to think that I was dealing with Elohim, gods, or even God. I could only know the answer to this possibility if open communication were to be established someday. Whatever the final verdict would be, I was now convinced that a contact had been made with a superior form of intelligence. But being realistic as to the atavistic nature of man, I knew that to disclose what I now knew would be to ask for martyrdom. Besides, it had been requested that Uri and I keep their secret. One of the mysteries of the cosmic being was its use of the biconvex disc shape, the flying saucer, to manifest on Earth to man and his instruments. I have no idea why this shape is used. This is a matter for future scientific study. I further believed now that if small and insignificant people like Uri and me were contacted and used as ambassadors to other people, there must be a large number of men and women on Earth serving as we were. I was determined to find others like Uri and me in the future. Uri and I both felt the personal solicitude of the cosmic being's interest in our welfare, feelings, health, thoughts, and actions. Also, why was there such concern about mankind's future as the result of a potential war conflagration between Egypt and Israel, which might escalate into world war? I wondered where else in human history there had been this kind of covert intervention in the interests of man's long-term welfare. I also chose to believe now that the cosmic being was essentially omniscient and omnipotent. If this was so, I wondered why it had to work through Uri and me. Was this because, as stated by the nine, they never interfere with an individual's will? Were we therefore being persuaded to exert our own human will to help mankind within a purely human framework of action? Then there was the more basic question as to how many degrees of freedom we really could exercise in what we were now doing. I wanted to find out eventually when and why the cosmic being chose to intervene in Earth affairs. And how many cosmic beings existed with respect to Earth. Was there just one, with multiple manifestations, or were there many? As far as humankind was concerned, much of the mystery of the energy of the cosmic being could be resolved by knowing the laws of creation and the creation of living forms, matter forms, and energy forms. Such laws are not known to contemporary science. In fact, man cannot even begin to guess at the nature of energy and its many manifestations. But the solution of this mystery could form the agenda of science for generations to come if it would take this problem seriously. My thoughts on this long night were more in the nature of wonderment and questions than convictions. They were more in the nature of an agenda for my future work as it existed in reference to Uri, the cosmos being, and myself. My night of thought ended as the sun broke over the Judean hills in the direction of Jerusalem. The next few days passed without any notable events. On December 12th I decided to give up my apartment in the Herzliya Heights. I wanted to be right on the seashore, where I could enjoy a greater sweep of sky and sea. It was with great sadness that I closed the door on apartment 61, where the most momentous experiences of my life had occurred. I moved to the Sharon Hotel Towers right on the beach in Herzliya by the sea. I had a room that was high above the sea on the 11th floor. Since this was the Hanukkah festival season in Israel, Yuri had many shows scheduled, sometimes as many as 4 in one day. We spent a great deal of time on the road, going to Haifa and to small towns in Galilee, as well as Safat, Jerusalem, etc. On December 13th I picked up a copy of Time magazine, which had a bold cover story caption that caught my eye, "Looking for Life Out There." The cover showed a man standing on planet Earth looking out into the deep space of planets and stars. The story was written by Los Angeles correspondent John Wilhelm. As I finished reading the last line of Wilhelm's article, I realized that its timing was truly prophetic. Perhaps it would teach that secret of survival to man. Perhaps this was my immediate task. And I felt incredibly helpless. How could I, a donkey, do anything to stop the huge juggernauts of war of many nations at this last hour? What I heard on the radio and read in the papers was chilling. The war between India and Pakistan over Bangladesh was polarizing the great powers of the world into dangerous positions. Russia had lined up her support behind India. The United States was supporting Pakistan. China, already in a border war with India, put her support behind Pakistan. And over and through all this tension, the Arab radio stations repeated day and night the threat of President Anwar Sadat that by January 1, 1972, the Egyptians would conclude the final solution to the Israel problem. That is, that the state of Israel and the Israelis would be liquidated. My concern for world peace was profound. I could not forget the voice and the words of December 1, 1971. But they made no further contact with us, although I repeatedly tried to invite a communication by hypnotic induction of Uri and the use of the tape recorder. It seemed that we were not only left alone but abandoned. We simply had to wait for the promised contact on the 20th. On December 19th, Uri and Iris came over to the Hotel Sharon to have lunch with me. As long as Uri was with me, I set up the TC-120 tape recorder and routinely asked the same questions: what can Uri and I do toward preventing war? As I asked this question, Uri and Iris simply sat with me and looked out over the sea. A few minutes after I asked my question, I noticed that the tape was running on record and the voometer was oscillating with the familiar pattern of speech recording. I said nothing to Uri and Iris but pulled the microphone out of the microphone jack to see what would happen. The voometer kept on with its oscillations. I knew then that I was getting some kind of a recording. This went on for some 3 minutes. Then it stopped. I didn't want to play the tape in front of Iris, so I stopped the recording process and waited to hear what had last recorded after they left. Uri and Iris left around 2:45 p.m. As soon as they had left, I started to rewind the tape back to the starting point. As I was getting ready to play the tape, I happened to glance at my wristwatch, which had been lying on a table. It had stopped at 2:45 and 45 seconds. I have already pointed out that my watch was a universal Geneve chronometer, with three extra dial faces as well as a large sweep second hand. The hour hand had stopped at 2, the minute hand had stopped at 9, and one of the small dials second hand had stopped at 45 seconds, making 2:45 and 45 seconds, or 1,445 hours 45 minutes hours. I wound the stem, it would not start. I listened to the watch, it was silent. I shook it would not start. It had really stopped, and I could not tell why. Then I played the tape. There was a message on the tape, recorded in English by a mechanical sounding voice: "Stay away from Israel Army. Do not interfere, pray for peace. Pray when your watch is stopped." Then the tape message ended. 5 minutes later the cassette vanished. I now knew at last what the stopped watch meant. I put the watch on and went out on the balcony over the sea facing Egypt. I prayed for peace. At 3:21 p.m., by local time, my watch began to run by itself. It had been stopped by an invisible hand for 36 minutes. The nature of my prayer seemed so sacred to me that I did not tell anyone about it. The next day, Monday, December 20, 1971, we had planned an outing for Uri's 25th birthday. Uri wanted only Shippy and Hannah and myself to go. For reasons that I did not fully understand, Uri wanted to spend this day in the Judean Hills with his three closest friends. We left Tel Aviv at 7:30 a.m. and arrived in Jerusalem by 9 a.m. We had no particular plan as to where we were going, we just decided as we went along. In Jerusalem, Uri wanted to go to the area where he had been wounded in the Six-Day War. We went to the area north of Jerusalem, and Uri remembered spot after spot where they saw that action occurred. Shippy, Hannah, and I could only faintly imagine what was going through Uri's mind. But thoughts of the evils of war were heavy on all of us. Uri decided that we must go on to the Dead Sea. On the way there we cheered our somber hearts with loud singing. As we neared the Dead Sea, I told my friends the story of how I had come here almost 2 years ago and first felt the magic of Israel. To reinforce the story, we went to the area of Qumran. I then told them the story of the Teacher of Righteousness, who was also Jewish, but more in the tradition of one of the Orthodox sects that they knew. The idea of the war between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness touched Uri. He said, "Doesn't Spectra mean light, like my name means light?" I said, "Yes, it does. Maybe this is what the Essens were doing here in the desert, watching for signs from a spectra." This thought with its depth in antiquity chilled our spines. Were we just the latest in a long line of recipients of light and knowledge? I then told them of my great sleepiness here in 1970, and that I now felt it was caused by one of the spacecraft that we were seeing. See page 62. We drove on down the western shore of the Dead Sea beneath the stark cliffs to our right and the deceptive blue sparkle of the sea on our left. We stopped frequently to take pictures and to run around like wild goats. It was like springtime for me to be out in the wilds with these three carefree children. At one time as I took movies, I lightly grumbled because I did not have my leather case for my NISO Super 8 movie camera. I was afraid of dust from the desert wind getting into my camera and ruining the shutter mechanism. Uri took notice of what I said. "Where is your camera case?" he asked. I was trying to save on weight, so I left all excess weight items in my home in Ossining, I replied. We drove on down the seacoast to Ain Bokek, to Sedum, and then turned inland. As we went through Arad, Uri suddenly announced that he had always wanted to see Abraham's Oak in Hebron. Would we like to go? We all said great idea and headed north. Only Shippy, in addition to myself, had studied the Bible, so between us we reconstructed the story of Abraham and the angels for Uri's benefit. This is how we remembered it. At the time, Abraham was living near Hebron at Mah. He was lying in his tent in the heat of the day when three men appeared before him. They seemed to be real men. Abraham treated them hospitably with food and drink as though they were real men. Then one of them predicted that Sarah, who was around 90 years old, would have a child. She, of course, laughed this off as blarney. The three men indicated that they were on a serious mission for the Lord. Then the Lord stood out from the men and told Abraham that he was going to pass judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. Of course, we had just been to the area now called Sedom, which was now only a wasteland, but believed to be the biblical site of Sodom. The Lord revealed to Abraham his plan to destroy these two cities because of their wickedness. Abraham found himself pleading with the Lord to spare the cities for the sake of the righteous people who were there. The Lord finally acceded to Abraham, saying he would spare Sodom and Gomorrah if there were only 10 righteous men there. Of course, we know the end of the story. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, and only Lot escaped. Uri was very moved by our poor rendering of this great story. He said, "You know, this is just like today. We are told by some invisible power that mankind is close to destroying itself. Somehow we get involved and are trying to help, but we are not really doing much. I really want to know if the Lord talked to Abraham. Were those men that Abraham saw actually from a spacecraft? Are the ones we talked to, the same ones that Abraham talked to? Uri, why don't we ask for a sign when we get there? Maybe we can get an answer to these questions, Shippy interjected. When we got to the Oak of Mma, we found it guarded by Arabs, and near it there was an Arab mosque and school.